Hello, entrepreneurs, innovators, and risk takers. Welcome to another episode of the Web3 with Sam Kamani podcast. And today I have a very special guest for you. He is the co-founder of Cubist. I am interviewing Professor Riyad Wahbi. So a bit about our guest Riyad. He wears many hats. Not only is he the founder and CEO of Cubist, but he also teaches students at Carnegie Mellon University as a computer engineering professor. He is a trailblazer in the realm of ZK proof. You know, he got involved with ZK proofs over 10 years ago when ZK proofs were not a thing. Riyad has significantly shaped the security infrastructure of major blockchains like Ethereum and Avalanche with his groundbreaking cryptographic protocols. In this episode, we delve into the vision that he has for Cubist and how it is going to change technology in future. He also simplifies and explains what is zero knowledge proofs. We talk about lots of other things, such as the problems that currently exist in the world of Web3 and what can be done. When will we see adoption of crypto or Web3? And I also ask him what are some of his contrarian views. And we dig into topics such as what is holding Web3 back. There are very few people as qualified to talk about future of crypto and blockchain and where the world of Web3 is going as Riyad. So if you are interested in any of these topics, then this episode is for you. Also, I do not monetize any of my episodes with ads. My only ask is that you leave a review on whichever platform you are listening this on. And nothing mentioned in this podcast should be taken as investment advice. This is a discussion about the technologies that make the world of Web3 and crypto and what is coming in future.
So Riyad, it's great to have you on the show. So looking forward to talking about what you're building. For some of our audience who are not very familiar with Cubist, can you please describe to them what is Cubist? What do you guys do at Cubist?
Yeah, absolutely. So Sam, thanks a lot for having me on. Really excited to be chatting. So Cubist is, you know, in two words, we're building developer tools, but maybe a few more words. We think a lot about security and we think about, you know, how people can build in Web3 in a way that's sort of reasonable from a developer perspective and also, you know, gives you a good result, which is to say, you know, gives you something that's secure that won't get you hacked. And the thing that we've been really focusing on recently is infrastructure for managing keys. So, you know, I think when you get into the space, kind of one of the first things that's kind of shocking about Web3 is that, you know, keys are kind of everything that you do. Like anytime you want to interact with a chain, anytime you want to, you know, basically anything you want to do, first you need a secret key, you need to generate a signature, you need to post the signature somewhere, something like that. So I think that ends up being one of the big distinguishing factors from, say, developing in Web2. And it also ends up being one of the hardest ones. And so we've been thinking a lot about, how do you build infrastructure that lets people kind of manage the way that their keys can be used, which is to say, you know, this key should only be used for this purpose. It should only be allowed to make transactions of this size, that kind of thing. So how do you build infrastructure like that? And how do you put, you know, in that infrastructure, ways of kind of thinking at a higher level about, you know, the interactions that you have with the chain. So rather than thinking about things at this lowest possible level of here, I'm going to generate a key, yep. I'm going to generate a signature on that key. I want to be able to say something like, look, my workflow is I want to deposit my Ethereum validator and then I want to start validating and later I want to withdraw. And yeah, along the way, there are a whole bunch of different signatures you have to generate, a bunch of different keys, but kind of that's one workflow. So building APIs that let people do these sort of complex tasks in a really secure and clean way.
Oh, that is fantastic. I will come back to this, but before we go further into this discussion, I would love to know, what's your story? How did you get started? How did you end up building Cubist? Because this whole field is so new. None of us grew up thinking that I will work in blockchain. Like, you know, everyone wanted to be a cop or a teacher or whatever. So yeah, what's your story?
Yeah, you know, it's Okay. Growing up. Okay. So I think the thing that got me into technology generally was this book by, I'm a little older than many people in this space, but this book in the 90s, Bruce Schneier had this very popular book called Applied Cryptography. And I think nowadays it's maybe not the book that you would read to learn about sort of modern cryptography. But back then it was like this amazing world of, you know, all these ciphers and RSA. And so I convinced my dad to buy me this book, which was slightly ridiculous. Like the book was bigger than I was, but it was this amazing book. And I just like read this book and I toted it around with me everywhere. And then I, you know, eventually decided, okay, I have to go into computers. I went to college and I ended up actually being an electrical engineer instead of a cryptographer. So I took this like weird left turn. I think mostly because I just like to get into the guts of stuff and build it. So I ended up building analog circuits for a long time. I worked in industry as an integrated circuit designer. And after a while doing that, I ended up working on things like, oh, how do we build tools to automate the way that the analog designer thinks about circuits? And finally, I got kind of nerd sniped by this friend of mine who was a professor at UT Austin named Mike Wolfish. Mike told me, you know what? It seems like you would have more fun doing computer science anyway. So like, why don't you just do that? And I was like, I don't know. That's crazy. I have a job. But eventually he won. And so I decided to go back to school. So I joined a PhD program. I ended up doing my PhD with Dan Bonet at Stanford, working on at first zero knowledge proofs and this sort of thing. And this was a little over 10 years ago. So, which was before ZK became this big, you know, thing in the Web3 space. And so we would get these amazing responses to like amazing, depressing, I don't know, responses to our papers. Like we'd write a paper and one of the reviewers would write back, well, this was a very nice paper, but frankly, it's a hammer in search of a nail. No one's ever going to use this stuff. It's too expensive, too. It doesn't make any sense. So like finally, then there was this amazing application in Web3 and, you know, building roll-ups and privacy preserving technologies. And that's kind of what drew me in. Like finally, there's this area that is actually doing stuff that I want to do, that I want to work on. And so, you know, I ended up working with Dan on some interesting protocols for like private airdrops. We worked with the folks at Handshake. This was, I don't know, 8 years ago or something, maybe 6 years ago on this private airdrop, this privacy preserving airdrop technology. We ended up working on the hashed elliptic curve scheme that's used in ETH2, in the signatures for the validators. And so we kind of really started out in the guts. I guess that's the theme, like always in the guts. And eventually kind of sort of bubbled up to the surface. Like how do developers actually use these things? How do you like actually bring all this amazing technology to more and more and more developers and get them involved in a way that actually like keeps things secure and makes people safe?
Amazing. You were doing zero knowledge 10 years ago. No one knew even about, I don't know, Bitcoin 10 years ago. Most people haven't heard of, let alone zero knowledge proofs. And you know, it's so funny. It's like now, if you go to a hackathon, half the projects there being built are on ZK, some sort of a ZK rollup, ZK proof, ZK something, you know, some sort of variation of that people are working in. And it is the hottest thing apart from using AI in your app at these sort of places that developers are looking at. So
it's so cool. And it's like so lucky for the academic. So I'm actually also an academic. Like I'm a faculty at Carnegie Mellon trying to kind of juggle both. But it's kind of amazing from an academic perspective, because suddenly there are all these students who have learned about ZK, not from their academic work, but because they've been active in Web3. And so they come and they say, oh, you know, I've been reading about the, you know, these blog posts on ZK, and I really want to do research on it. And it's I don't know, it's a little bit of an inversion of the normal way that people end up in research, but I think it's fantastic. And so the academic community has benefited massively from this.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And coming back to Cubist, and you know, one of the things that you did mention about that keys are everything. And, you know, like how before I pressed the record button, we were talking about, or I was talking about decentralization and centralization in this space, that I like decentralization, but one of the biggest flaws of decentralization is that there is no customer service in decentralization. If you send Bitcoin to someone or if you lose your keys, then God help you, then that's it. So it's like, how do you think decentralization can solve this problem of lack of customer service?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I mean, that's kind of one of the $1 million, maybe the $1 million question. Yeah. Area, right? How do you provide a good user experience while still getting you know, all the benefits of decentralization? Like, how do we, and I think there are a few different answers to it. So I think one that doesn't work for everyone, but does work for a significant and really, you know, important part of the population is education. Like, what I'm seeing, you know, with my academic hat on is I'm seeing more and more students who are getting into this stuff and getting into, you know, not just, you know, not just like sort of the investment side of Web3, but the deep sort of tech side of Web3. And so they see this and they think, ah, this is something that's important to know, something that's important to learn. So I think we will actually see an increase in the number of users who are, you know, who came into it, decided they needed to learn. And as a result, like really are able to sort of help themselves. But that's not like, that's not the 90% answer, right? Like 90% of the world wants, basically they have, you know, they have a Google login. They want to make their Google login kind of work for Web3, right? So, 100%. And I think what we're going to see, I think the happy state is not forcing everyone to be fully decentralized, right? We need, like, to me, the nice thing is to have the option because, you know, if for me personally, I want to take advantage of that decentralization. I want to, you know, sort of manage things a little more carefully. I mean, I'm the kind of weirdo who's been running my own mail server since 1997 or something, right? So like, I'm like the person who, like, for whom the decentralization story was made, right? But you have to realize that, like, you know, my dad doesn't care about that. Like, he doesn't want to run his own mail server. He definitely wants to have customer service. He wants to know that if he makes a mistake, you know, somebody's going to take care of that. So I think what we're going to start to see is a couple different changes. One, we're going to start to see technology that helps those users to kind of exist in a world that they're comfortable with. Something that kind of provides the interface between the sort of totally centralized experience and the totally decentralized infra underneath. And I think that's going to look like a few different things. That's going to look like, you know, better key management technology that gives people the option, you know, gives people a sliding scale for, you know, how complex, how low level control they want versus how much they want to just sort of fire and forget. And I think there are good points along that scale. And so being like offering people the option is going to fundamentally bring more people in. I think the other thing that's going to help a lot is a little bit of a shift in the community's attitude. So I tend to see a little bit, and now I don't want to sound like a nag here. I don't want to sound like, oh, you know, we're doing things wrong in the community, because I don't think we are. I think we're doing a lot of things really right. But one thing I think we tend to maybe not get quite right is the way we interact with new users. Because this is like a super technical and very technologically savvy, you know, group of people generally sort of in the space already, I think we tend to interact with one another in a very kind of tech forward way. There's a lot of jargon. There's a lot of, you know, acronyms. There's a lot to know, right? Like, people just come up to you and say, hey, what do you think about EIP 4337? And like, okay, so I was at ECC last week and there were all these conversations about 4337 going on. And, you know, if somebody like from the outside wandered in, they'd think we were speaking a different language. Well, okay, in Paris, we were speaking a different language, but fine. Right. So we need to be like, I think as a community, just a little better about understanding our audience and understanding that, like, if you want to bring in those next people, it's good to sort of make ourselves more approachable. And I think part of that is, you know, part of that is a little bit an attitude towards the decentralization maxis, or maybe not towards them, but from them, that like, maybe like having that choice is actually good. And maybe it's okay if people don't choose to be at the maxi end of the scale. And then sort of also maybe a little less jousty conversations about the way, you know, wallets should work, or the way that, I don't, you know, this sort of thing. So I think a little bit more accessibility by the community will actually make things better, because it'll sort of give people permission to innovate in a way that actually does end up a little more centralized, but ends up sort of inviting more people in.
Oh, absolutely. I cannot agree more. I do think so that, you know, people care about convenience more than they care about privacy or decentralization or everything else. You know, most people, like, who live day-to-day lives, you know, they just want convenience. And we need to, if we want to be everywhere, then we need to accommodate that 98% of the people who do that. Like, it's still very small. Like, you know, if you look at the daily active users on Ethereum or something, it's like 300,000 compared to, if you look at an app like Duolingo that's got 10 million daily active users, So it's like, that's how small the active people are in our industry. And we are fighting for a small slice of a very small pie. So if you want to grow the pie, yeah, we need to make it convenient for anyone to get in and start using it. So yeah, I mean that's what I think. So tell me a bit more about Cubist. So is it mostly founders and developers of other Web3 apps who currently use Cubist, or how does it work?
Yeah, so we've been talking with a few different kind of groups within the Web3 community. So the folks we started out talking to were all in the Ethereum validator space. So folks who are running big validator pools. Yeah, exactly. So our first, you know, the first customer that we announced publicly was Anchor. We're working with them to, you know, sort of power their ETH liquid staking protocol. So we're kind of handling the key management there and helping them with the security. And it, you know, what's kind of amazing is how I kind of mentioned this already, but like how complex all of that is, right? Like it's like, if we take a step back and just think about Ethereum started out as this proof of work protocol. And then, you know, through this series of at first small changes and then eventually one really big change, just kind of ripped out the guts and replaced them entirely with this staking protocol, right? So, and as a result, partially as a result of that, and partially as a result of just, you know, the fact that this is a very complex thing to do, period, the design of the staking, like the life cycle of a validator, the way that the validators work, all of this is quite complex and is going to continue to get a little more complex as we see the protocol evolve. So like recently with Shanghai, we saw the ability to withdraw. I mean, that adds a whole other layer of complexity on top, right? And fundamentally, it enables liquid staking in a much more reasonable way. And so this is kind of an awesome thing, but it also is like hugely complex. So I think one of the things that the folks in the validator community, like, you know, folks running liquid staking protocol, one of the things that they're fighting is they're simultaneously trying to provide quite low level infrastructure, right? Like they're running machines that are like have to be online all the time, but then also they're running these like super complicated cryptographic protocol. And I think worrying about those two like ridiculously different levels of abstraction at the same time is actually like a very, very complicated thing. So that I'd say the viewpoint that they have on, you know, always up, you know, making sure that the network is healthy and this sort of thing, that's a super interesting one. And it's actually, as far as I can tell, you know, slightly unique. So that's a big group that we've been working with, and we've learned a lot from them. Another group of folks that we've been talking to a lot have been, you know, people who are thinking about how to improve the experience for users who are, you know, interacting with Web3 for the first time. I think what we're going to start to see, speaking of predictions about how things are going to grow, I think one of the things we're going to start to see is that the new users, or the, you know, a huge number of the new users in the next few years won't know that they're using Web3 at all. They're going to have a wallet as sort of a side effect of installing an app, or, you know, signing up for a service or whatever it is, or maybe an existing service will convert to using a Web3 backend. And this is something that I learned from speaking with this sort of group of folks who are in this area of, you know, kind of user facing, whether that's explicitly a wallet or whether it's something else more like user management. I think one of the reasons, like on the business side, that people are doing this is because it ends up giving them much cleaner data. So when folks are doing things like loyalty programs or, you know, consumer programs for like, you know, tracking behavior of different grocery store customers, like your loyalty program for that or whatever it might be. I think one of the big problems today is it's very hard to get clean data from that sort of thing. You know, people tend to do things like share the grocery card among a bunch of people, or, you know, they type in a random phone number that happens to work, right? And as a result, like people end up with, the companies end up with this like messy data. And so I think one of the solutions that we're starting to see emerge here is to use Web3 for that. And that's like, that's kind of interesting, because what it means is like, it's completely invisible. Like it's not like I'm buying anything. I just happen to be using this application that underneath is using cryptography, and it happens to be using it for sort of a clean data reason. So I think we're going to see a huge number of new users in that vertical. Of course, one of the really, really exciting ones is gaming. And there, I think you see a range, right? You see people who are in it because they want to play a AAA game, and it happens that AAA game is on-chain. And at the other end of the spectrum, you see people who are like, I want to play an on-chain game. You know, it's super interesting. I want to be following this technology. So I think that one tends to span the range a lot more in terms of like how sophisticated the demands are of the end user, whether it's like, just get out of my way, I want to sign in with Google, or whether it's like, you know, I need to have, you know, multiple devices and I want to have this specific relationship. And so it's sort of all, and yet like all of these things are at the bottom key management, right? Like, and so this is like sort of this interesting thing about the space is that there are so many different things that all boil down to like, how are you managing the key? So we've been, as we've talked to all these different verticals, we've learned just kind of a ton about how each one thinks about the keys, but also like how wide the range of uses is.
Oh, that's fantastic, because I 100% believe that we will not get adoption of this tech till we require people to learn. It's only when we don't need people to learn about the underlying tech and it's invisible, that's when we will hit adoption, because that means people are using it for the real utility that it provides. So for example, when I switch on TV on my remote, I don't need to learn how infrared works, how light emitting diodes work, how liquid crystal displays work. I don't need to know about anything. I just switch on the remote and I know it works. It will work. And at the most, I have to change battery. And same thing, if we bank, people don't need to learn how relational database management works, RDBMS works, and you know what sort of a stack it's using. And right now we require people to learn everything if they want to get involved in this in this crypto world. So the thing is that it needs to be invisible. It needs to be a black box, and we just use it for the utility, not because there's going to be an airdrop and then we all leave after that. So that's my key thing. And I have so many thoughts about gaming because I worked in gaming and I advise startups in the space, in the gaming space and stuff. And, you know, one of the danger signs I saw in early 2022 that I thought that, oh no, this space is going to be in so much trouble is when there were more companies, there were more marketplaces for gaming assets than there were games that people were playing. So it's like everyone is making marketplaces to sell and trade gaming, Web3 gaming assets, but there's no games. Every game is in development that will be ready in 2025 or 2026 if they manage their funding well. If not, they're not going to even survive. So no one is playing it for fun. Everyone's playing it for trading, and that could only sustain till there was someone else paying a higher price for the asset. So we needed games, and I still feel like we need consumer facing apps that are solving problems if we want adoption. So have you come across any apps that you find really promising on the consumer facing side? Yeah, in this space.
Yeah. So without going into like specific names of apps, just because, you know, I haven't spoken with anyone and said, hey, is it okay? But yeah, you know, I think that, you know, in terms of broad categories, I think there is some really interesting tech coming in terms of, you know, not necessarily a totally new application, but instead an application that today people do, you know, kind of in a totally centralized, like, identity is a great example of this, you know, totally centralized way. Like, I give my identity completely to Google or whatever. And then like I log in and I share my identity, and like, it's sort of, this is kind of a mess. And I think everyone kind of knows that this is like bad, or I don't know, maybe many consumers think it's okay. It's giving something away and getting something back.
People,
yeah, it's true. Right?
It's
like, get
so
something
convenient.
Out of it. Right?
You just click log in with Google. It is so convenient. It's made everyone's life so much easier. That's why people use it. Otherwise people won't use it.
Absolutely. And so that's the key, right? Exactly as you said, the convenience factor is the most important thing. And so I think what we're going to see is we're going to see applications where you can actually get meaningful privacy that is still convenient, right? And
that
so that's the,
amazing.
That's, yeah, right. Which is now kind of the best of both worlds. So like things like we're starting to hear about, you know, the self-sovereign identity type applications, you know, more generally this notion of anonymous credentials, like, you know, if I need to, you know, prove to you that I'm, you know, eligible to participate in something, I don't have to give you my whole life history to do so. I just kind of give you some proof, maybe a zero knowledge proof, for example, that I'm actually eligible without giving you any other information. And if that is just as easy to do as the kind of the non-privacy preserving version, I think that's the kind of thing where we're going to start to see, okay, now it kind of makes sense. I actually still hold out hope for, you know, I think everyone kind of has this notion that like the Brave browser has been trying to push, you know, these kind of micropayments for services and sort of avoiding ads and, you know, maybe even getting paid for browsing. I mean, so getting paid for browsing starts to feel a little bit like the play to earn model that
yes.
I think exactly as you said, like felt a little bit like the danger zone. Like
yes.
as soon as we're playing games to make money, it's no longer fun.
Exactly.
So
right.
I worry a little bit about
it
that.
It becomes work.
Exactly. It right. It's like I go yes. home from work and I just start my other job. But on the other hand, I think there are interesting things along these lines, right? Like if I'm privacy conscious, if I don't want to see advertisements, if there's a super easy way for me to sort of micropay for each story that I read or whatever it is, like that to me is like quite compelling. And I think that as we make that kind of thing easier and as we start to see more integration of kind of the Web 2 and Web 3 economies, like that actually will become a plausible path forward in a way that it's not today, mostly because it's just too annoying. So to me, that's like a super interesting one. I think there still are really cool opportunities in the gaming space. Like I think going to see really awesome games in Web 3. You know a lot more about that than I do, but like just from my vantage point as somebody kind of talking about the infrastructure that underlies the games, like I'm super excited about what I'm
yes.
the little bit that I'm hearing. But as I said, you know way more about that than I do.
Oh no, the thing is, we just need good games that are fun to play. That's all. Pretty much once we have that, people will pay. People don't even expect to be paid. People will pay anything it takes to get that dopamine fix. And in fact, it is counterproductive sometimes. So this is an experiment that's been done like multiple times. And like, you know, one of the best ways to discourage kids from reading is to give them a reward. So say it's like if a kid is interested in reading and loves reading books, and then you start saying that, hey, you know, every time you finish a book every week, I will give you a Pokemon card or whatever the reward for that kid might be. The kid will start doing it for that reward. And once that reward stops, they will stop. They'll hate it. They'll feel ripped off that I did all this reading and now you're not giving me. So that has shown to reduce the desire to read in kids. So I think reward plays a counterproductive. It's just like people join the projects because of the airdrop, not because of they want to really use or it's really providing a utility. So I don't have an answer of how to not remove fun from a project by giving rewards, because it's such a human psychology thing.
I think you're totally right. Not only is it a human psychology thing, there's also just like very interesting, you know, incentives on the part of the project, right? I want to get people involved. I want to get them to like start using it on day one. So I do this massive airdrop and it's, you know, you have to figure out a way to do it without shooting yourself in the foot, which is a tough thing, right? Exactly as you point out. So yeah, I think this is the kind of thing that we're still like learning. If we think back to, you know, I don't know. I'm trying to remember when I got my first like non-Prodigy internet subscription. So I mean, obviously, I keep giving evidence that I'm old. But you know, it was a very different kind of weird place to exist on, right? To be on the internet. You know, first of all, you had a modem, you dialed up, and all of this, right? So like, there were all these kind of things that made it a high barrier to entry. And, you know, only quite technical people were doing it. You know, email wasn't important. It's not like you, you know, got an email from your utility provider telling you, hey, remember to pay your bill. Like, no, they send you something in the physical mail. So I think over time, we just kind of saw, well, things got a little easier to use. Things got a little easier to develop. There was that a huge hype cycle right at the beginning, right at, you know, 1999, 2000, the dot-com boom. And then, like kind of, and a lot of that was totally silly, right? Like it was just like burnmoney.com or whatever it was that was, right? But somehow out of that emerged like these applications that were not at all obvious at first, right? Like I don't know, YouTube was 2003, 4, something like this.
Yeah.
And it like totally made sense that you should have this amazing like archive of videos, but only after you saw it. Like nobody was saying in 1997, well, what we really need is this huge archive of videos on the internet where people, no, nobody thought of that. Right. So it's so interesting that the things that emerged, like in retrospect, of course, they're a good idea. But before we saw them, like, wow, that who would have predicted that? And I think we're going to have the same thing. I think
absolutely 100%. It's like not non-skeuomorphic innovation, you know, because initially we have the skeuomorphic innovation and all the apps look like the icons look like the real world things because they are from the real world, but then eventually we have Snapchat with a ghost. We didn't have it's just a logo. So now none of the apps look like a real world because there is no real world equivalent. And just like, you know, ask what people want. They want a faster horse because they've never seen a car, but we just like don't know. When we had the brick phones, we didn't know. If you ask them what do you think the phones would look like in 15 years, 20 years? And none of them would say we'd be taking pictures of our breakfast and putting it on the internet and all that. So they would not think of that. They just wanted a slimmer, smaller phone. So it's the same thing. Like the innovation that will come, none of us would know. Just like probably Satoshi didn't know, like or that team didn't know making Bitcoin that people will be trading monkey pictures on this deck. That's what it will be used for in 2021 predominantly. So it's just like, we don't know what will come in the next 5 years. And that's why we need people like you to build that infrastructure. So it enables that non-skeuomorphic. My question is, I don't know. Do you have an opinion on like, where do you think that innovation is going to go or what it would look like in next 2-3 years, 5 years? It is so hard.
Well, okay. So one thing that I think is definitely going to be the case in the next 5 years is the innovations will move up and up and up the stack. So I think if you look at the way that just like now, this is kind of like a nerdy thing, but like just look at the way that these companies that have, you know, been built so far in Web3, look at the way that they're built. They're very vertically integrated. They build essentially everything themselves, right? And I think the reason for that is kind of clear. Like there's no option, right? If I'm building a Web2 business, like everyone would call me crazy if I didn't start by building on Amazon, right? I'm like, well, first I'm going to build some bare metal servers and I'm going to write an operating system for it. And, I mean, no, nobody does that. But you basically do the equivalent of that in Web3, right? You kind of start from nothing. You start from like the lowest level, like here is my RPC node and I'm going to deploy some smart contracts and, right? And everything is like super duper down in the weeds. And the result of that is like, it's kind of hard to go from there to an amazing product. Like, it's very difficult. Like it's just a skill that is very, very rare to like look and see like here is this barren landscape and on it I could build this amazing tower if only I built all the full tech stack first. Like that's such a hard leap to make, right? Yes. But like as people build more and more and more of the stack, like as it becomes easier to, you know, deploy cross-chain apps, to communicate across different chains, to manage your keys, to do testing, to like all the stuff that's kind of table stakes in Web2 or the, you know, the moral equivalent of those things. Now, suddenly somebody comes in and says, well, good, good, good. I don't have to worry about that stuff, but I have this great idea, right? So I think what we're going to start to see is much more sort of horizontal building in the next several years because like the infrastructure will kind of be not fully there. It's going to continue taking a while to build. Like AWS didn't come about in a year. It was like, you know, AWS today is like unrecognizable from the AWS 5 years ago almost. Well, except EC2, which has just been amazing forever. But, you know, so it's, I think that's going to be the biggest change. If you look at the way that a 2018 Web3 company looks like as an organization versus the way that a 2024 Web3 company will look as an organization, the biggest difference will be much less in the way of focus on building low-level infrastructure and much more in the way of, you know, here's our product. We can use these other infrastructure products to build it out.
Yep. That is so amazing. You have changed my thinking in just this one conversation of what I used to think. And you made me more positive about Web3, even though I've been in this for ages. I was trying to set up a miner in 2012 for Bitcoin and stuff, and I failed and stuff, and trying to download software from LimeWire for it to start. And I was still had a low powered like a laptop, and even in 2012 you couldn't do that. By that time there were already professional miners there, so I was like, this is so hard, why will anyone use it? But now I can see why. I mean in a few years I could see why it will be useful and why there is a use case. And just like that, I had a thinking that, you know, most of the Web3 startups are solving Web3 problems. They are not solving real world problems. But what you said makes so much sense, that because you have to build this whole tower, you're still down in the reeds, you have to still build this whole tower, that the Web3 has those problems that need to be solved before it can go out in the world and solve real world problems. So That makes so much sense. Apart from Cubist, are there any other projects or technology that you are really bullish about?
Oh, yeah, let's see. That's a good one. So look, as a person who does research in ZK proofs, like on the academic side,
yes,
I love ZK. I mean, notwithstanding certain comments that I might have made on a panel last week about ZK being still way too hard to use, which it is, I think like ZK as a technology is amazing. And there again, like it's sort of, you know, the motif is there. Like it's this amazing technology that's so hard to use. And we have to spend a lot of time building the infrastructure to like let people use it. But I think in general, the kinds of technologies in ZK that I'm most excited about are the ones that let people build on top of stuff. So like rather than, you know, the kind of old school way of building in ZK was sort of to build everything yourself. You start from the proof system, you write constraints in this super low level way. You're kind of thinking about your problem at the most minute level of detail. And unfortunately, what that means is that it's very hard to express anything. And so, you know, as we're starting to see more of these systems that are letting people write in, you know, more like a computer programming language that, you know, normal humans would use. And that kind of technology, I think, is going to be hugely enabling. We're going to see new applications of ZK that nobody's thought of yet because it's just too hard to see them through the, you know, yes, through the trees. So I think that one is I'm super excited about. I'm advising a company, Modulus Labs, who is working on ZKML. I think it's a super interesting area. I think there's a really good marriage of sort of succinct proofs and, you know, machine learning inference that kind of helps us sidestep the high computational costs on chain. So I think it's a really good application of succinct proofs to do like computationally heavy work off chain and then bring it on chain. I think there's a lot of cool stuff to be done there. Yeah. And I think more generally, the kinds of tech that we're starting to see in the, so, okay, I don't want to say scalability because I know that like rollups have kind of are here and have been here and will continue to be here. So I think that's a super exciting thing. I think if we start to see, you know, big payoffs from rollups, that'll be super cool. I'm much more interested in seeing what we can do with kind of very, very application specific thing where people are building, you know, because they have this one specific really heavyweight computation that needs to be done off chain and then brought on chain. That's the kind of thing where I think we're going to start to see really, really cool work done. I'm super excited about this question of generally sort of compiling from normal languages to ZK. This is something that my co-founder Fraser and I actually have worked on academically with Alex Ozdemir, who's a PhD student of Dan's at Stanford. We have this project called Circe that's a compiler for kind of zero knowledge proofs broadly construed. So I think this is like a super, super, super cool direction. And then I think the last thing that I'm really excited about right now, although this is super nerdy and low level, but if anyone has a use for it, I would love somebody to like get in touch and let me know. I've been thinking a lot about like post-quantum proofs of storage. So that is to say, like I like store some huge piece of data and I can prove to you in a really short string, like that I actually have the data stored. So this is a technology that people have been thinking about for a while. I've been thinking about kind of a new construction of it. And I would love to know if like people have interesting applications for this. I've just been kind of nerd sniped by the like low level technical problem, but I don't actually have an application for it yet. So we'll see.
Oh, that's fantastic. And what about for Cubist or just for yourself? If you haven't asked, feel free to share if there's anything you are looking for, people to try the product out or you're raising funding or anything, feel free to share.
Well, look, yeah, always interested to hear, you know, if people have kind of tough problems in the key management space, interesting applications, you know, things where it's like, look, it's really tough to solve this kind of problem today. I would love to hear about that. As I said, I would also love to hear about the post-quantum proof of storage application, but that's a separate thing and just for fun. But yeah, generally speaking, look, if you have a hard problem that has to do with keys, I want to learn about it because I think the more we sort of shed light on the problems in the space and the more we understand the relationship of those problems to one another, the better off, you know, the better product we'll be able to build and the better solution we'll be able to put out there.
Well, that's fantastic. That is super practical. And I really like that you are still trying to learn from people to solve real problems, which is, you wouldn't believe, but it is still rare for Web3 because people are so deep involved in their own space that they forget to look out and forget to solve problems for people. So I don't know why I always feel like I see that more in the Web2 world than in Web3 world, because in Web2 world, you always start with, you know, what is the problem, how big is the problem, and all that. So now when I look at a project, I often look at through the lens of, okay, what problem is it trying to solve? Is it really a painful problem, or is it just something? And can Web2 solve this problem with much ease? So just some of those things. But I think you're doing all the right things. How does, in an ideal world, how does the future look for you in the next few years, 3, 4 years, 5 years? What would you like to see if it was all up to you?
Yeah, wow. Let's see. So I think to me, the big one is kind of nailing down scaling on chains. I think we're still struggling a little bit with that. I think even, you know, has been discussed a lot, and we're starting to see some of the payoffs there, but maybe not as much as we might have hoped. So I think scalability is a big one. I think that really nailing the sort of user onboarding story. So really getting it to the point where it's totally plausible for me to like tell my dad, you know, dad, I think it's time. I think it's time that you have a wallet. It's going to be really cool. You can, you know, send payments to people. Like that would be a great world, right? Like, I don't think we're in that world today. I would not tell my dad to go get a wallet and, you know, buy a bunch of ETH or Bitcoin or whatever, because yeah, I don't think he'd get any use out of it. And I don't think that he would have a good experience with it, right? He would call me and say, this is so hard to use. What are you doing to me? Right. So I think that'll be a great one. I think, you know, maybe this is like a, asking for something dangerous, but like, I really think that, like, as with the internet, you know, we had this kind of notion in the late 90s. Sorry, this is a slight sideways answer, but
yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
In the late 90s, there was this notion of the eternal September, right? What was the eternal September? Well, okay, every September, a bunch of new, like a bunch of undergrads would like get access to the internet for the first time. And there would be this month long period where like there were these kind of noobs swarming the internet, and everyone would notice because like the internet was tiny and mostly just centered around university. And this was like September, right? And the eternal September was the point at which like the flood of people coming into the internet just made it such that like constantly all the time there were like these people who just like they didn't know stuff that the old people on the internet all knew, right? And it was used in this really bad way, like, oh, well, now all the noobs are here forever, right? But that's what actually, that was the point at which the internet became useful, right? Like yes. Before the eternal September, the internet was like kind of just a plaything, and like you'd go and like search through, I don't know, I guess at that time, Lycos or whatever, InfoSeek, and follow around some web rings or something, right? And yes. Like this was, right? Like this was the internet and it wasn't useful. I mean, it was cool. It just wasn't useful, yeah. Right? And then after eternal September, like maybe it became less cool, but it became a lot more useful. So like, I think like the ideal version of the next several years is we actually start to see like hundreds of millions of people using Web3 for real stuff. And yes, those people will be on the whole less like technologically savvy than the people who are there today. Almost by definition, if they were that technologically savvy, they'd already be there, right? And so like for some, that will be like a little bit like, oh, well, Web3 used to be cool. But no, that will be the point at which we know that it's gone big. That will be the point at which we know that it's useful, because then there will be people there that are actually using it, not for the technology, but for the utility.
I have 2 points to that. Right now, there are 2 types of people in Web3. One is people like you who are really, really, really tech savvy, who really are into their technology and who are really passionate about building something big. And then there is the other crowd that are in it for the price, the token price. You would have noticed I didn't talk about any token price of anything. They are only interested in that. And that community is a lot, lot bigger than people like you. So even now there are 2 different sections. One are into the whole trading, investing, that side of thing in it for the, they are not from the technical background. And then there's the other side, which are like the cryptographers, the people in tech working with smart contracts, working, running their node, all those sort of people. Like, so they're still, I think we still don't have the mainstream crowd yet. And, you know, it will only work. A lot of the things that you are building infrastructure for and the tech and stuff that I'm also exploring, it will only work if it has mass adoption, because it needs like network effects and economies of scale. Just like login with Google didn't become big until Gmail became big. until everyone was using Gmail. Because even when there was Google, just like google.com for search, people didn't have account. It's because of Gmail, people got the account. And then Google Drive and all those utilities came first. And then the login came. So with this also, we need those consumer-facing apps that solve our day-to-day problem. And once those are there, then the login will become ubiquitous. It will be everywhere, like Web3 login. People will just use the wallet and everything everywhere. So I'm still looking for what's that, you know, that killer app that solves. Like one of those killer apps is stablecoins. In my point of view, it solves real world problems. Another is store of value, but it is like long-term store of value like Bitcoin, but that is so centralized and still not as big as transfer of value with stable coins. That is changing things. And then the third is the trading and all that. But I'm still looking for what's that, you know, the next big utility that, like the app that people will use day to day, everything. And it might be something non-skeuomorphic that we haven't come across yet, because we are looking for a faster horse, and there's airplanes there waiting to be invented yet.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I love that, by the way, non-skeuomorphic. Yeah, that's exactly the right way to think about it. I think it's just, yeah, if we can think of something today with our current technology that's like, oh, that would be a cool thing to do, and we could build it, yes, you know, in Web 2, then like, where's the motivation, I think, to build, yeah, it in Web3? Web3 is like a fundamentally amazing technology, which means like it enables things, right? Like it otherwise wouldn't be such cool technology, right? And so the fact that it enables things, it doesn't mean that like all of those things are obvious. Exactly as you said, like there are airplanes waiting there. I think we haven't quite found them yet.
But I love the ones that you horses and
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. I do love, I mean, I think I mentioned this one earlier, like the sort of micropayments, the kind of super, super easy, like, I think that's very related to kind of the stablecoin direction, to, you know, generally being able to do payments without the sort of wild swings in value. I think, you know, more and more separation between things that are really for payments and things that are really for, you know, investing. I think that kind of helps a little bit to get, you know, a consumer in to feel confident, to feel like, okay, I could actually use this and not worry that tomorrow it's worth, you know, 10% of what it was today, right? So yeah, I think absolutely that's a super interesting direction, and it's one that, you know, I think we will see more and more and more people use.
Fantastic. Do you have 5 more minutes? I have one last question.
Absolutely.
I've really enjoyed this conversation so much that I have gone over my time limit. What's been your key takeaway from ETHCC?
Oh, wow. So ETHCC was really, really interesting, I thought. So I started out beginning of the week, before the week started really, at the DeFi Security Summit, which I thought was super cool because, you know, over time, the DeFi security space has kind of morphed from, you know, people thinking just about, you know, auditing smart contracts or whatever, to people thinking about, okay, how are we going to ensure these things? How are we going to, you know, kind of add the sorts of, you know, professional services that you tend to see in, you know, in Web 2, right? So like all of the threat intelligence, and, right? So this I thought was like kind of amazing to see all these people in one place really kind of talking about security from so many different angles, so many different and interesting things to think about there. And then, you know, sort of as an offshoot of that, I was chatting with some folks about the you know, on the wallets panel, where we had an interesting conversation about 4337. Kind of as an offshoot of that, I thought there was a lot of interesting, you know, 4337 related discussion in general at ETHCC. I thought it was super interesting that, you know, this was something that was only, account abstraction was only, you know, standardized just before ETH Denver, or maybe at ETH Denver, right? So just over the last several months, we've already seen this kind of huge explosion in folks trying to sort of build on account abstraction, trying to push in that direction. So I think that's a super interesting angle that I saw there. And then, of course, you know, I love chatting with the folks in the ZK space. It sounds like there's a lot of cool kind of anonymous identity stuff up and coming, which is really exciting for me. So I'd say those were the big ones for me. I saw a lot on security, a lot on account abstraction, and a lot on you know, anonymous identity and ZK that was all super, super exciting. And then I guess the other big takeaway for me is that there are so many different and interesting angles to approach user-facing wallets specifically, right? Like account abstraction, lots of folks are really excited about how that's going to, you know, help build better experiences for users. you know, there are a lot of folks who are thinking hard about how to make MPC work really well for the end user. You know, our approach at Cubist is sort of based on trusted execution environments and hardware security modules and how to make those work for the end user. And so I think the fact that we have kind of a lot of different technology means that we're going to be able to sort of build a lot of different shapes that fit a lot of different users. And so just thinking about how all of those kind of relate to one another, it was really, really exciting for me.
Oh, that's fantastic. What's the next developer-focused event that you're planning to go to?
I'm really, really excited for DevConnect, which is Istanbul. In Istanbul.
November.
Yeah, that's going to be fantastic. Yes. Absolutely.
Oh, that's fantastic. So yeah, I'll most likely probably will go there. So we should catch up for a coffee or something and talk about all the tech and everything.
That'd be great. Thank you.
So it's been an absolute pleasure talking with you. I always get so positive after talking with people who are focusing it from the tech side and building the infrastructure for the next generation to build things on top of. So it's really good to see.
Likewise, I've really, really had a great time chatting. I'm so glad that we did this, and I'm looking forward to that coffee in Istanbul.
Sure. Sounds great. Thank you so much for tuning in and listening or watching this episode of the Web3 with Sam Kamani podcast. By now, you know the drill. Leave a comment or share this episode with a friend and leave a review. I would love to hear from you. So that's why my DMs are open. Reach out to me, especially if you are a founder building a product in Web3. Then I would love to hear from you. What are your challenges? Is there anything that I can help you or my community can help you with? Thank you once again and wish you best of luck in building your startup or your project.